Praise 100.9 and 92.7 Charlotte's Inspiration Station. This is Community Voices with Ron Holland, exploring the issues that impact our community, providing an in-depth analysis of the latest national discussion, and hitting the issues hard in a thoughtful, passionate, and provocative way. We have another thought-provoking show for you this morning. The events in Ferguson, Missouri continue to dominate the national headlines. Discourse and debate of all types are being had. A dear friend and filmmaker was on the ground in Ferguson and was able to interview residents and capture the frustration many of the folks in Ferguson have been expressing about the police shooting and killing of unarmed teen Michael Brown. That interview is coming up here on Praise 100.9 and 92.7, Charlotte's Inspiration Station.
Community Voices with Ron Holland. In-depth analysis, thought-provoking, and hard-hitting. Community Voices with Ron Holland. Giving you an opportunity to share what's on your mind and in your heart. Community Voices with Ron Holland on Praise 100.9 and 92.7, Charlotte's Inspiration Station.
Joining me via telephone from Atlanta, Georgia, is my friend Mike McMahon. He is an independent filmmaker and video production specialist from Neptune, New Jersey, living in Atlanta. He first studied media production at New Jersey City University and graduated from the Art Institute of Atlanta. He is also a youth minister and dedicated mentor, founder of a youth ministry called God's Young Men at Redemption Community Church, where he is a lay minister. Mike, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you.
Absolutely. I am so glad that you are safely back in Atlanta. I know that there were some tense moments out there in Ferguson. First of all, what prompted you to go out to Ferguson knowing that there are some very interesting dynamics going on there?
Well, the craziest thing is that I actually was invited. I was hired to come out there to shoot another journalist wanted to do some interviews, and I was asked to go out to do the shooting for him. But you know, there was a couple of things. I was reluctant at first, but then somebody was sharing a video on Facebook in which an off-duty white cop was like riding around the area where the protesters were protesting, and you know, saying some things. I don't know if I can repeat on your station, so I won't say them. But you know, it really moved me to think, wow, I want to go down there and get that story.
Yeah. You know, interestingly, there was a police officer this week that was suspended from duty as a result of his holding up an assault rifle at the crowd, and individuals were trying to get his name, and obviously he refused, and he spouted off a whole bunch of expletives. Did you find that kind of sentiment from the police officers there?
You know, Ron, first, the entire event, I got there on Saturday morning, just within hours after the first case of the looting, and so everything was still fresh, and that was also the day that they had the big press conference. There was a march and a rally with Jesse Jackson, and I got footage of that. But this was the first day they imposed a curfew. The rally and the protests themselves were peaceful. They were beautiful. People, black and white, were unified for the cause, and there was no problems until it started getting dark on the Saturday night when they first imposed the curfew. When it started getting dark, and I have footage of it, the cops started rolling in and lining up on, they mobilized and they lined up on both sides of the street. It's a very small area, and just their presence was intimidating and just changed the whole tone of the entire thing.
Right. Do you think absent the police presence, there would have been a more peaceful demonstration?
Of course. And there was.
Yeah.
The whole day was peaceful. It was nothing but love. People were giving out food, dropping by with water, whites and blacks. You know, there was a couple of showers, and you would see, you know, the corner thug was sharing an umbrella with the old white lady. It was good. It was a wonderful thing. It restored my faith in humanity. Actually, but again, it was the whole order. And I should tell you, to put things in context, this is only like a 3 or 4 block area.
Right.
The area itself is not that large. You don't need the National Guard. You don't need every state trooper to be there. You know, so just the fact that they had so many cops standing by and waiting to mobilize was intimidating in itself.
Yeah.
It was a very small area. It could have been handled a lot better. But it was all nothing but peace. like I said, until they started enforcing their presence.
Right, right. You know, this week, Attorney General Eric Holder visited Ferguson, and it was in an effort to convey his concerns about the ongoing investigations of the shooting. Based on your interaction with the folks there, you've been able to meet a lot of folks.
Yeah.
Do you think his visit will calm some of the tension that has garnered so much national attention?
Unfortunately, I believe that it will a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
He's like a token of Obama being there. But unfortunately, I don't think that people understand that the capacity that he's able to do anything about it is really limited.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they would really have to prove that the young man's civil rights was violated. You know, if you can't even prove that either he was murdered, you know, how are you going to say that the civil rights was violated? So I think it was more so a photo opportunity. And I really believe, unfortunately, that was a time for them to make face.
Yeah, yeah. Now, there's been a clarion call for, particularly from folks in the media and probably folks on the ground, for President Obama to visit Ferguson. Were folks expressing a similar sentiment there?
Yes, you will see in my footage, there was two ladies who had a life-size cutout of Obama,
mm-hmm.
and they were saying, "We need him. We were there for you. We need you to be here for us."
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that was a sentiment everywhere. Everybody was asking, why isn't Obama here? If Obama was here, that would calm everybody down immediately.
And do you think a grandiose speech would calm some racial tensions that are there? I mean, what else could he actually do other than to show himself and to be amongst the crowd? Is there something that he should be doing on a national level? Like I said, a grandiose speech that would indicate the kinds of problems that are taking place in the black community.
Well, I think he has the power, just with his sheer presence, to reassure people that, you know, at least he believes that something should be done.
Yeah,
we're talking about people who have been quite oppressed. We're talking about people who are descendants of people who knew their place, you know?
Yeah.
And people who were... I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's okay.
People who...
Well, this is what happens with interviews via telephone.
Yes.
So that's okay. Don't worry about that.
Okay, yes, well, I believe that... I'm sorry, can you repeat your question?
Yeah. In terms of President Obama and mm-hmm. his presence there, outside of his, hugging folks and being amongst the crowd, is there something the folks on the ground want him to do? Perhaps give a grandiose speech about racial tensions in this country, about black oppression, about interaction with the police? What else should President Obama be doing as expressed by the people that were on the ground there?
It seems there was a general consensus that his sheer presence would reassure them that, you know, they would be able to continue to exercise their constitutional rights to protest.
That was
a general feeling that I got.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things that piqued my interest about your visit was something that you wrote on your Facebook page, and you indicated that there perhaps is a misperception that where Michael Brown was gunned down, that it's a ghetto. But you're indicating that the area is relatively nice. Talk a little bit about that.
Very much so. It was not basically. This whole area was a white area not long ago.
Mm-hmm.
There was a mass white exodus, of course, once black people were able to start moving into that area.
Yeah.
And there was a shift racially that left, the people and the residents became black, but the people in power, never gave up, their clutch on, the city administration and the police department.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And talk a little bit about how the residents feel about where they live. Now, as you've indicated, there is a political vacuum there. Black folks are not in power. But what are the folks feeling on the ground in terms of where they live? Do they appreciate the nice area that they live, or is there such a detachment from the community that they simply don't care?
No, they understand that they're in a nice area, they're in a comfortable area,
mm-hmm.
but I think they from what I understand, the voter turnout for in 2012 was huge, but the next year in 2013 it was minimal,
mm-hmm.
For the municipality elections, and that's how that was a small example of why we're not more represented than that government.
Right, right. Give me a better sense of the anger and frustration people are actually feeling, because we hear the word anger and frustration, mm-hmm. but what we saw over the air, it seems like the anger is more visceral. You have folks throwing rocks and stuff at the police officers.
Yeah, and again, that was provoked. Mm-hmm. That was provoked. There was a tangible anger, but it was again generational anger that has been simmering for generations.
Right.
I have an interview with one young man, who, for example, who was talking. He started calling off different names of other black victims right there in that same general area, mm-hmm. that had happened. One young man in 2012 actually was a spiritual guy, and he caught the Holy Ghost and was in the middle of the street, and they say the cops just pulled up and tased him, and because he had a heart murmur, he died on the spot.
Wow.
And so, you know, there are a lot of preceding incidents that, you know, this was just a boil over,
yeah.
you know. And the anger is more so about how they're treated still like second-class citizens.
Right.
You know, they don't, again, if you remember, the anger was really about how long the body was left laying in the street, mm-hmm. first uncovered and then even covered. You know, they don't believe that. You know, they would have done that, of course, if he wasn't a black boy.
Yeah, yeah. Now, being on the ground, obviously, you were able to see a whole bunch of stuff, interact with a lot of individuals there. But talk about the moment where the police donned in military gear, strapped mm-hmm. with military-style weapons, having a really imposing presence, especially with the armored vehicles. Describe that experience.
It was just surreal. I had never seen, you know, and I've been in incidents like, you remember the riots in Belmar. Mm-hmm. I had never actually seen so many police officers line up in full riot gear, mm-hmm. you know, shields, batons, and all. And as I said, it started early. You know, the curfew was imposed for 12 o'clock, and it was like 8:30, you know, when the sun started going down,
yeah.
that they just started moving in on the streets and lining up on both sides of the streets and just making, you know, just like telling, you know, it was almost like a threat. And immediately the whole dynamics of the day changed.
Yeah.
We went from peace and unity to fear, anger, hate. I seen one young man yelling at a cop saying, "You just mad because, you know, you want to hit me so bad, but you can't. There's nothing you can do about it," because
yeah.
right behind him was television cameras.
Right. And, you know, that's a perfect segue into my next question, because I'm wondering, again, outside of the officer being suspended for displaying his assault-style rifle at mm-hmm. Individuals, I'm wondering about the constraints the police department actually have, because obviously there's some verbal constraints, some physical constraints, but the nonverbal communication is what I'm interested in.
Yeah.
How were these police officers reacting to the anger and frustration that people were expressing, particularly the young folks who would boldly come up to an officer and express his feelings? How were the police? What did you see from their faces to indicate that there's a problem?
Well, I can tell you that at one point I was in the middle of the street. They had young men standing in the middle of the street handing out roses to people as they drove by. And one young man said, "Hey, turn around and get that. Turn around and get that." And by the time I turned around, of course, and with the camera, there was a squad car that had already pulled off. But
mm-hmm.
basically, he described to me, and I saw it, but, you know, I couldn't catch it on camera. There were, you know, that the car was deep with police officers, and they were riding up and down the street with their own personal cell phones taking video mm-hmm. of the people who were protesting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that rate, and he was saying, they're trying to intimidate us, and he said they were laughing as if to say, you know, when all of this hype dies down, we know who you are.
Wow.
Yes, it was
wow.
crazy.
Wow. And you know, interestingly, as the story unfolded, and I remember the first time that I saw the video of Mike Brown stretched out on the ground, obviously deceased. During that weekend, I had probably seen about 10, 15 different videos of police interaction with the black community. And 99.9% of it is negative.
It is.
And I'm getting the sense from people that are so frustrated with this that uh-huh. it's going to move beyond people filming.
Yeah.
You know, because when you see a woman being pummeled on a highway by a huge police officer with these huge arms, and she is defenseless. People are going to start reacting to this outside of just filming it. I'm afraid what's going to happen is that people are going to start intervening in a way that's going to be detrimental to the police. Do you get that sense from the folks down there?
Yes, of course. And in fact, there were a number of young people who came out and flat out said, you know, this was not a hood or a ghetto area, but you still had young men who were influenced by the gang culture that were around, and they basically came out and told me, you know, if it wasn't for the respect that we have for the people out here, you know, we would be retaliating now.
Yeah. And that's interesting because, again, I'm interested also in the sentiment of the peaceful protesters who had to contend with the fact that there were looters amongst the crowd. How were those demonstrators reacting to the looters and all the vandalism that was taking place?
Well, again, it was blown out of proportion. I'm not saying that there wasn't. Of course, there was looting. If you notice, though, their cameras were out there all night, but they were looping the same 2 or 3 minutes worth of footage that they had. Basically, the stores weren't so much destroyed and looted as they were a group of people who were just so frustrated they broke the glasses out of the windows, for example. But when I first arrived there, you know, and I arrived at my hotel, and I turned on the local news. And they were talking about how the Domino's was looted and burned down, et cetera, et cetera. And then when I got over there, Domino's was open for business selling pizza. Okay?
They're going to make their money.
Yeah, they made a fortune.
Them
and McDonald's.
Yeah. So what's your overall impression about the business owners there? I mean, obviously there's concerns that, you know, there could be potential looting of their particular business.
Well, here it is. It was contained within a 3 or 4 block area, as I said. Just beyond that area is a great big, nice Walmart shopping center. And that is where the command center was set up. You may have saw on the news on Sunday night, you know, protesters that were trying to approach there. The police spun it as though they were trying to come and get into this area when they were, you know, basically they were just trying, they were tired of being confined to the same area, marching up and down in a circle. But this particular shopping center has political investors, you know, including the DA himself, from what I understand, a mayor, and a couple other folks that, you know, they don't care how much you tear up those stores down there, but you weren't coming up here and doing anything. And when I tell you that it was a Walmart parking lot full of state trooper and other surrounding area cop cars, that's what it was. It was like a fortress.
And of course, people are going to be a little upset about being herded around as if they were cattle. Talk a little bit about the, because interestingly, I have read something else on your Facebook page where you were communicating with the folks that you met in Ferguson. And there is a sentiment that the prosecutor may not be as impartial as he's given credit, at least particularly by his supporters. Give me your impression about how people are feeling about the prosecutor, because I get the sense that if this guy does not get indicted or charged or arrested, there's going to be a much more explosive reaction by the community.
And there will be, and it is inevitable. If he doesn't recuse himself and let someone else do it, it will be. There was an incident in which there was a drug raid, and two young men that was in a car were shot to death by the police. He refused to indict them under the grounds that the police officers claimed that the car, they tried to run them over with the car. And we've heard that in plenty of other police shootings before. But then evidence came that the car was not moving, or the car was maybe even broke down or something like that. I can't remember what it was. But when they asked him after the fact, you know, how did he feel about that? He said, well, I think that they were bums then and they're bums now.
Right. And again, which suggests it actually contradicts the idea that he can be fair and impartial.
Exactly.
I simply don't think so.
You did
some great work reenacting the murder of Trayvon Martin. In fact, you got thousands of hits on YouTube for that excellent work. How soon should we expect to be able to see the work that you've done in Ferguson?
In the next couple of days. In the next couple of days. I've been up all all night working on it right now. And in fact, I have a gentleman here at the station that's waiting for a copy of the audio to play on his at his radio station. But I've been working on it. It's so much. It's so much. And then not only that, but the whole the incident. And then as we see, social media is flooded with all types of different police brutality videos, mm-hmm. and I'm just kind of exhausted. I wish I could just take a break for like a week and then jump back into it. But of course, we know that this story, it's important that I get this done now while the story is hot. So
yeah.
I'm going to keep on trudging through it, and hopefully it'll be done. I hope to have it up on YouTube as soon as tonight.
Right. Okay. Now, you are a stalwart in filmmaking, and certainly I appreciate that. What do you say to folks in Atlanta, in Charlotte, Ferguson, New York, anywhere, now that this is gain national and worldwide attention, what do you hope folks will do in ensuring, first of all, that Officer Darren Wilson is arrested, charged, prosecuted, and convicted for killing Michael Brown? What do you hope?
I hope that we can look past that and demand some kind of social change where, if nothing else, for example, there should be federal law that all police officers should wear body cams as well as dash cams.
Yeah, yeah.
That would make everybody feel a lot safer and have a lot more trust in the police. But, you know, I've heard that in places where they were implemented, police brutality allegations went down as much as 88%.
Wow.
And, you know, and it's important. Not only that, but the Ferguson police actually, through the federal government, has those cameras but refuse to use them.
Yeah, and that's why I think Reverend Sharpton's call for a national standard is certainly important. And I do want to convey to folks, because one of the things that, you know, I'm a little bit bothered by, I think the call for justice is too abstract,
yes.
Particularly in this case. There needs to be a strong advocacy for this man to be charged, arrested, and convicted. That should be the clarion call. Yes. Saying we want justice again is too abstract for me.
Yes.
We need to be clear and concise about what we want.
Exactly.
Well,
and unfortunately, Ron, I really think that, you know, we will not get the justice that we hope to get. So that's why I'm thinking to look beyond this incident.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, you know, we're going to probably have to lose a couple more of our young men. But hopefully, I think that, you know, I got a sense from being there at the rally that it was universal with all people. We're just tired of hearing about stories like these.
Yeah, yeah.
And something's got to be done.
Yeah. Well, Mike, thank you so much for joining me this morning to talk about your experience, and I am certainly looking forward to seeing the footage.
Yes, sir.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Now, if you want to see a video clip of some of the footage that Mike McMahon shot while he was in Ferguson during the protest, you can log on to YouTube and search for St. Louis Woman at Ferguson Protests gives you insight to the police shooting of Mike Brown. You can also search for MMX Multimedia. Now, I want you to take a listen to this.
So today, when the black man starts reaching out for what America says are his rights, the black man feels that he is within his rights. When he becomes the victim of brutality by those who are depriving him of his rights to do whatever is necessary to protect himself. And an example of this was taking place last night at this same time in Cleveland, where the police were putting water hoses on our people there and also throwing tear gas at them. And they met a hail of stones, a hail of rocks, a hail of bricks. A couple of weeks ago in Jacksonville, Florida, young teenage Negroes were throwing Molotov cocktails. Now, Negroes didn't do this 10 years ago. But what you should learn from this is they're waking up. It'll be Molotov. It was stones yesterday, Molotov cocktails today. It'll be hand grenades tomorrow and whatever else is available the next day.
And that was Malcolm X, and his words are almost prophetic if you take into consideration the events that have played out in Ferguson over the past few weeks. Black folks are tired of being disrespected. They're tired of being harassed and harangued by the police. And I know that the peaceful demonstrations are what we should be striving for, but I must tell you, the young generation is growing increasingly intolerant of the injustices that they have been a witness to, the injustices in our system. They're tired of police officers getting away with brutality and beating and overzealous policing. They're tired of all of this. Now,
the looting and vandalism that we've seen is inexcusable, and it's difficult to convey to young, unorganized, and angry groups of young folks that looting and stealing on the heels of an obvious injustice. It's difficult to convey that they should express themselves in a different way, not in a negative way, especially given a history of negative interactions with power-tripping police officers bent, my friends, on exerting control through bullying. It's difficult for them, and difficult even for many of us grown folks, to convey to them that they shouldn't conflate peaceful protest with a yearning to express themselves in a way that we may not particularly be interested in, that perhaps might even cause them more trouble. And I think we as a community, we need to be able to channel all of that energy, all of that outrage into not just a moment of frustration and a moment of anger, but a nationwide movement. That's what we should channel these folks into doing. And I issued a challenge recently on my blog, on Facebook, on Twitter, and even on these airwaves, that the Bloods and the Crips and every other street gang out there, they should turn that life of negative, destructive behaviors, killing folks and shooting and being a drain on our community, and transform all of that energy and all of that negativism into the biggest political movement in this country. That's what they should be doing. They have the sheer numbers. They have an organizational structure. They have the discipline, albeit for the wrong things now. But just imagine that discipline being exercised at the polls or in the community in a more constructive way. Just imagine that. I want you to take a listen to this.
How do I know y'all a singing group? Aren't y'all saying something?
I got nothing but love for you, baby. Got nothing but love for you, baby. Got nothing but love for you, baby.
Now, I'm quite sure many of you remember that scene from the movie The Five Heartbeats, and that particular scene, and I think a lot of folks who have encountered really bad police officers know that it is a similar issue, dehumanization and humiliation, and nobody wants to be dehumanized and humiliated by the police, particularly when you are doing absolutely nothing wrong. And I've been hearing all of this conversation about black folk and black parents, black men having this quote conversation, end quote, with our young boys, because there is a potential for a negative interaction with the police. I am sick and tired of having to explain to our black boys how they should act when they encounter a police officer, particularly an officer who is bent on exerting control over them. Now, for the sake of their safety and so that they can come home at night, we have that conversation. But why is it that we have to have the conversation? Why isn't the police departments all across this country instructing these police officers when they are interacting with any community, but specifically our community, why aren't they being instructed to appropriately interact with us? That's stirring my ire, because we are human beings deserving of the respect that we have as human beings. And we have to have this conversation. White men are not having this conversation with their boys. And I want you to understand this, because I hear this nonsense about Michael Brown stealing from the store. Listen, understand. White girls are more likely to steal from the store, from any store, than black boys. But they are not being shot down in the street. Police officers are not shooting white boys down in the street. And some of those white boys can be the most disrespectful people that I've ever seen, particularly when they're drunk and high off of whatever. They are not being shot down in the middle of the street. So yes, we ought to have that conversation with our children. But it galls me
I'm almost insulted that we have to have that discussion. Why the hell are we required to have this damn conversation? And I asked this question last week on my show. Why aren't these officers properly screened for potentially violent behaviors and a disposition that could lead to altercation or death? Yes, we ought to have that conversation, but there needs to be a bigger conversation in this country about how police officers are interacting with our community. How the hell can a police officer get away with pummeling a 51-year-old woman on the highway, beating her, punching her, blow after blow after blow, and no repercussions? How in the hell can we allow police officers to shoot our young men in the street and there's no repercussion? I'm not talking about violent repercussion. What I am saying is that they have lost the right to be called law enforcement officers when they disrespect any of us on the street. This nonsense has got to stop, because the reality is there is no parity, no equity in a situation where black police officers are shooting down young black men, and then you have a situation where white men in various states across this country can walk around with rifles on their shoulders and guns on their hips, and there is no response from the police. These folks can point assault style rifles at federal agents and they are not being gunned down. You have white boys who are going into school systems and shooting up entire classrooms, but when they are caught, they are walked out with handcuffs. But in our community, black boys are being shot down. There is no parity here. And I'm not suggesting that officers should be shooting down white boys. What I am saying is that there is an inequity, and I have a problem with that. We're going to take a quick break. When I come back, I'll wrap up the show. This is Community Voices with Ron Holland on Praise 100.9 and 92.7, Charlotte's Inspiration Station.
Praise 100.9 and 92.7, Charlotte's Inspiration Station. I want to again thank filmmaker Mike McMahon for coming on our airwaves to share his experience and perspective of the events taking place in Ferguson. We're going to continue watching the developments of the shooting death of Mike Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. It's my sincere hope that Officer Darren Wilson is arrested, charged, indicted, prosecuted, and convicted for gunning down young Michael Brown. And we're certainly going to continue praying for Mike Brown's family, Michael Brown Sr. and Leslie McSpadden. This is Community Voices with Ron Holland. If you have any comments on today's show, please send me an email, ronholland@radio-1.com or ronholland25@yahoo.com. I also invite you to visit my blog for some insightful and provocative commentary, www.ronhollands.blogspot.com. Today's show is also available on our Praise Charlotte website as well as our Old School 105.3 website. Thank you so much for tuning into this week's Community Voices. I'm Ron Holland. We'll talk with you next week.